You're listening to Pushing the Envelope, life at the cutting edge of customs innovation. I'm Tom Muller with the Cross Border Research Association. And on this show, we explore the frontiers of customs creativity in conversations with customs and logistics experts, technology innovators, research scientists, and other leaders in the field. Industry insiders call this show the Pencast because it's part of PenCP, a network for boosting customs innovation funded by the European Union under the Horizon 2020 program. Today, I'm speaking with Professor Andrew Granger, an academic, teacher, and trade facilitation practitioner with over 20 years of hands-on experience in the field. He works closely with universities and research institutes around the world and has frequently contracted with government agencies, companies, and international organizations. He has also led a series of projects that deal with risk and uncertainties at UK ports and port development supply chains, especially in the food sectors. Professor Granger has written more than 100 articles, studies, book chapters, and other publications, and in 2021, published a groundbreaking book, Cross-Border Logistics Operations, Effective Trade Facilitation and Border Management, which Kunio Mikuria, Secretary General of the World Customs Organization, said should be on the reading list for anyone in the public or private sector whose work touches on cross-border logistics. Professor Granger, Andrew, if I may, thank you very much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. It's quite humbling.
You didn't know that you'd done all those things, did you? Or you're probably too
well. I'm all in for mischief, and this is sort of a career of mischief. And once you line it all up, it sounds really exciting.
And the fact is, I took excerpts from about 20 pages of your CV. So perhaps I chose inaccurately, but there's a lot to choose from.
There certainly is. I mean, it's a strange career if you sort of look back, starting off as a humble freight forwarder and somehow ending up in academia and research as a consultant. I think it's probably what people might refer to as a patchwork career.
I'm sorry, say that again. People might
refer to that as a patchwork career.
Patchwork career. Well, I know something about that, being a freelance journalist.
So absolutely.
Patchwork is my friend. And the fact is, though, that you having worn many hats instead of following a single career path gives you unique abilities to see and understand from different perspectives. I get all the time on this show people saying, well, I just can't talk with industry, or these researchers don't understand, or these government people really don't get where we're coming from. You've worn all three hats, so you can really see behind a lot of the agendas and the kind of mindsets that are present in the three different areas.
Absolutely. And it's probably not just free, it's many more. So it's when people ask me, I mean, I have a young son, so it's, Daddy, what is it you do? It's sort of the careers day event at school, and you sort of blush, and then you try and think in layman's terms or child's terms to explain, Daddy, me, what do you do? And you go like, well, I ask questions, and then I try and find answers for them. So next question is like, how much do you earn? And I go, oh, depends who's paying. But bottom line is, it's always different perspectives. So you stay true to your domain. So it's trying to help people move goods across borders. And it would have started off as a freight forwarder. I don't think I was a particularly good freight forwarder because my cargo always got stuck in customs.
You learned something about what needed to be done to fix that, right?
I certainly did. And it was a baptism of fire. So my first real job was in Southeast Asia and in Europe. But things got more difficult in Southeast Asia when I was in charge of construction projects and engineers are shouting for drill, steel, dynamite, explosives, what have you. And you realize the paperwork you have is extremely shoddy and your job is to tidy it up and suppliers can't provide it and all sorts of things go wrong. And it suddenly becomes sort of a question you sort of start asking, like, so why everything that I'd learned at university when I studied transport logistics, sort of lean, just-in-time management, why does all that sort of stuff not work? And the answer was obvious. It was because my in-tray wasn't moving. And why wasn't it moving? Maybe because I didn't know what I was doing, but there were lots of other good reasons as well. And long story short, a bit of soul searching, I decided to do a master's in the politics of international trade. It was at the time of the Asian currency crisis, so there were lots of redundancies at the time. So it was a good way to sort of find my way from hands-on type of work and go into academia research and ask these sort of questions. And after that master's, I sort of ended up with PricewaterhouseCoopers as a customs consultant. So that's when I realized all the things that I might have done wrongly or received bad advice on and bad steer. I sort of began to appreciate actually how you might do it properly. I went on secondment to the UK government to join CITBRO, which then was a very proud organization with almost a history of 40 years to look at the interface between business and government and how conversations can be had on eliminating any bureaucracy or red tape to make ports and borders work more efficiently. And to be fair for me, that was the making of me. I had wonderful peers and we looked after quite large stakeholder groups. We could easily reach out to the entire UK business community, capture experiences in a very informal way, and then make recommendations to ministers or the UK then being part of the European Union, coordinate positions with UK government, but also that of other private sector, but also government bodies. To maybe work towards improving European customs legislation, which then was the Community Customs Code that became the Modernized Customs Code and that became then the Union Customs Code. So I've been through all those iterations in my career at the cusp between the public and private sector. And because that was so much fun and so much mischief and being through all those different organizations, hearing all those different views, I decided to, in the evening, enroll on a part-time PhD.
Because you didn't have enough to do during the day, of course, yes.
Absolutely. But in a sense, I mean, maybe this sort of reflects on sort of how this subject gets under your skin. You can do a lot. And if you play around with ideas, yes, it's complaints from the private sector because operational things don't work. But drivers from the regulatory side, well, it's the law. But what is the law? It's something that can be negotiated and made to work for the needs of society or the stakeholders and the like. So you can bring those political forces, the economic arguments, the needs of different stakeholders. You can play with those sort of ideas. And there's theories in supply chain management about operations and competitiveness, which was a big theme towards globalization and the like. But you can also play with themes like regulation, better regulation, security, control. 9/11 was sort of smack in the middle of the years in which I started finding my ideas. You could really play around, and different stakeholders, interested parties have different needs. And certainly for organizations that subscribe to trade facilitation, making procedures more efficient, but mindful of the needs of different stakeholders and how to come together, you can really sort of play scenarios and games that might work, that meet the respective stakeholders' needs. And as an academic, that's fun. And so you do this as a day job, but in the evening, you start playing around with the theories that might be behind it, and different disciplines have different things to offer.
I think you were being very modest when answering your son's question. Daddy, what is it you do? I do the most important job in the world, son. I mean, facilitating free trade is among the most important jobs in the world. And you're clearly, in a position to help that process evolve swiftly from
very different. I'm fortunate enough that he still believes that.
How old is he?
Moving towards 13, yeah.
Okay. So he is a teenager. Well, fair enough.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, good for you. Today, I mean, in a sense, your book published in August of 2021, Cross-Border Logistics Operations, Effective Trade Facilitation and Border Management. Is it fair to say that that is a kind of a concretization, a summation of the learning that you have done from various different vectors over the last 20 years?
Inevitably, my academic journey, my personal development, and that of my research output, it's all interlinked. You have opportunities, you write things up, and as you go along. So the motivation for this book, in part, for a long time, I've been a teacher at the University of Nottingham, teaching students about supply chain management theory, logistics theory. And what was missing, in my view, is the whole regulatory interface. So we're teaching students about operational efficiencies. We're teaching them about competition between businesses, how to take advantage of global export markets, how you can configure one supply chain to be more competitive than another. So great theories, great operational tasks, but the interface or the interactions or the overlaps with the regulatory requirements, that is absolutely not on the curriculum. And you do find there are people that are trained in that, but they are maybe not familiar in supply chain management operations or transport. And motivation there was to, certainly as a research career, populate that area. The book I wrote, in part, it's a bit like a chicken and egg. If there's no book, then peers might feel reluctant to put something like that on their own curriculum because, you know, they would like to read up about it before they ask students to do something.
Sure.
So that was sort of my motivation to start reaching out to publishers. And you sort of have the choice. Do you go with publishers that come from a legal background and look after that field? And I sort of felt, well, actually, there are some good books there for people with legal training about customs law or trade law. But for those who come from an operational perspective, trying to make logistics efficient and lean, maybe I should push for a publisher that has a good leg in the logistics and supply chain management domain. So hence, that's why the title doesn't start with customs, it starts with cross-border logistics operations. But it's all about customs and border procedures and non-government agencies, how that affects efficient logistics operations with those regulatory requirements, but also those operational mandates, needs for competitiveness of the private sector.
Yeah, I was struck by the long list of warm recommendations by many distinguished figures in international trade, including the Secretary General of the WCO, a professor of international relations at LSE, and many others. It clearly is a book that meets a previously unmet need. Is that fair to say?
I would like to think so. I mean, of course, the publishing landscape is a strange one. If you did something about accountancy, you got a huge market. If you did something about economics, you got a huge market.
Right.
If you did something on tax, it already becomes a smaller market and not that many institutions look at that. If you did something on supply chain management logistics, it is mainstream in many places, but maybe not as mainstream as marketing or something along those lines. So you sort of go down in the hierarchies of potential book sales. But of course, in our world, we know that supply chains drive everything. And you only have to look at, for example, COVID and disruptions to supply chains there, how important efficient operations are to everyone. And in a sense, it might have been opportune timing for a publication of this nature to maybe find its way into the community of those that have to think about training and development programs.
It seems like a wonderful tool for training, for teaching, for, I mean, it really does, as you read it, you really get a sense that this could be a perfect textbook.
Certainly for that type of reader, whether it's somebody who wants to just familiarize themselves with the subject, because they might be at home as a customs practitioner with a training in border management or the legal aspects, and they just need to understand the supply chain aspects of it, or the other way around, somebody at home in logistics and transport, but they want to become aware of regulatory aspects. So what I have done is each chapter concludes with a few leading questions that lend themselves to self-study, which a reader might pursue. Or alternatively, if you're an educator, it becomes a reference resource, so you can use those questions to maybe reflect on when you engage with your students in classroom activities. So food for thought, classroom discussions can become quite lively, and hopefully this book will help conversations in that sort of context.
Well, your energy and enthusiasm, liveliness, troublemaking, as you put it earlier, that is evident throughout the book. I mean, what makes this subject so exciting to you?
It is probably the opportunity to play around with boundaries and borders. But borders don't have to be borders between countries. It can be between disciplines, between different ideas, between different perceptions. And when you have got regulatory dimensions, operational dimensions, recently I did some workshops at Rotterdam School of Management, and there people were asking questions about compliance, but then you had borders in corporate hierarchies that were interesting in order to sort of get things through. So sparked by the challenge of how do you manage borders, quite simply from a customs perspective, you quickly find there are borders everywhere. And
there's
just a lot of opportunity for good. You call it troublemaking, mischief, playing with ideas, to maybe look at the subject through fresh eyes, new eyes, different eyes. And I keep learning new stuff away, look at it. So a few years back, I did a sabbatical in Australia with people who specialized in tax, and they were looking at it as a simple compliance problem and weren't quite appreciative of just how many dimensions there are to the customs domain. But I learned from them ideas about, you know, if you write a letter differently, you get different responses. They were talking at psychological aspects. So suddenly I was talking economics and they were talking impact. So you realize there's this whole lots of new ideas of looking at things and pushing the field and pushing the envelope, as you say, to bring this into mainstream research and academia or the curriculum.
Exciting.
And greater professionalism, of course, too.
Yes, right. Right. Now, especially in professionalism, I believe some of the book was inspired by the WCO's professional standards, also known as the WCO
Picard
standard. You contributed, did you not, to the WCO's Picard program?
Well, the WCO is very good at reaching out to relevant communities. So you feed in a constructive way, you put things. So they've developed a good standard as a starting point. It's something you can make reference to. It's a standard where you can have conversations about what a customs professional should take away with. And it makes reference to things that customs officers or senior customs managers need to know if they want to be good at their job. And it's informed by peers. So that's why the WCO reached out to people like me and many others. But if you look at it from a textbook point of view or a curriculum development point of view, you realize, yes, human resource management is really important. There are resources available for that. Brilliant. Logistics is important. There are resources available for that, which is brilliant. Mm-hmm. But if you sort of look at how things fit together, there was something missing. And this is sort of where I took inspiration from the Picard standard by looking at it overall and thinking, well, if somebody had to learn about customs and wanted a primer, an introduction, or an overview resource, and maybe they can't dedicate 3 years full-time training as a customs officer, often customs or border compliance or border management is something you do in addition to something else, and maybe training might be just over one term rather as part of another degree, for example, then a resource like the one that I produced, I felt would be really useful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. To take a step back, trade facilitation, or how to ease the flow of goods across borders through simplification and harmonization of customs procedures, is a widely discussed, but I think it's fair to say generally poorly understood topic. Why is that for something so critical?
It reminds me of a question when I started off my PhD journey, and I was much younger, and I was working for CITPRA, the UK Trade Facilitation Agency, and I said about, we've got these ideas about how to make borders more efficient and meet regulatory needs, and the response was very deadpan. So, Andrew, if it's so explicit, obvious, why aren't we doing it? And I was thinking that, actually, that's a really good question. It became much of it defined to me. It really is obvious. It's a no-brainer. And yet, there are so many obstacles. Sometimes people make reference to cultural obstacles. In my case, often it was about defining what is trade facilitation. And then again, being a mischievous person in that argument with my supervisor back then, said, if there's no one official definition, how shall we proceed here? And I said, hang on, I got a fix for that. It was in the early days of Wikipedia, so I wrote a definition and put it onto Wikipedia.
And it was then the official definition because you'd put it on Wikipedia.
Yeah, absolutely. And much of it is still there today. So people have edited and tinkered with it. But what I put down there back then, I think in 2006, probably. So you sort of realize it does mean different things to different people. For some things, it's a very broad topic. For other people, it's a very narrow topic, maybe very specific to the WTO Trade Facilitation Agreement. Mm-hmm. Certainly in the world that I grew up in at CITPRO, it was about anything that transpired out of conversations between the public and private sector that could make borders less of a barrier, less of a friction to international trade.
It's extremely so broad or narrow. Why might the subject of your book, Cross-Border Logistics Operations, be more relevant than ever today, especially within the context of economic development and reducing the barriers to trade, but also in making sure that regulatory needs are appropriately met?
And there's so many ways to explore this narrative. So yes, definitely in operational context, it is relevant. And if there's disruptions to supply chains, be it regulatory driven, be it inefficiency driven, then yes, trade facilitation is right at the core of it. It's also very attractive in the context of trade negotiations, trade agreements. So it's become a mainstream topic in bilateral trade agreements, regional integration and the like. So there's the old challenge. So we got rid of the tariff barriers. Next question is, so if the tariff barriers are gone, why isn't there more trade taking place? And the answer is, well, there's the non-tariff barriers. And a big part of that is the perceived lack of trade facilitation. So it's the absence of it, or maybe it's not good enough. Maybe there's trade facilitation measures in place, but there's still scope for improvement when you compare it to how other countries do it. And there is maybe a third element that's quite interesting, and it is also a way for governments to engage with other countries at a very low diplomatic level. So between countries and officials to maybe share regulatory models, so you can work on experience along those lines. So there's a lot of scope for mutual learning, aligning countries and bringing them closer together, which of course might be at the heart of what much of contemporary trade policy sort of driven from.
Right. Your book is filled with clear practical examples and case studies on international trade from a political, administrative, regulatory, technological, economic perspective. And there's a long list of potential participants who would, you know, potential readers who would benefit from reading. One member of this list leaped out at me: disaster relief operations. Why would your book be useful for people involved in disaster relief?
Well, it's from an educational point of view, of course, this is where the narrative shifts from saving costs to saving lives. And if you're in a classroom, people really pay attention because, yes, I'm in it for making money and a profit or being more competitive. But it's just a reminder that societal needs are more than just economics. And if your goods are stuck at the border because some paperwork is not filled, and the result of that is somebody dies or many people die, it has a very different emotional. So that's why strategically I chose it to put it in the last chapter of the book, because it's a nice way of summarizing the subject in a way that can make it very relevant to individuals. But of course, it's really important. And I wrote much of the book just before COVID. Subsequent conversations lend themselves well to the sort of lessons and solutions that people have taken away from the COVID response, and maybe how that as a driver can make the operational interactions between border agencies and those that have to comply with regulatory requirements a little better. So lessons learned sort of lend themselves well in sort of that disaster narrative.
I can imagine that some second edition is in the offing with COVID, with Brexit and the Northern Irish border, with Ukraine, of course, yeah. Donald Trump's misbegotten attempts at trade wars and so on. Things are moving so fast. You probably felt like you were shooting at a moving target.
Perhaps, but the principles are roughly the same. It is about, just like in supply chain management, when various stakeholders up and down the supply chain. So in the business school sense, you would be talking about suppliers and buyers and manufacturers, how they would coordinate things to make or orchestrate things to make sure that what they bring to market is as competitive as possible. What I'm trying to do is add to that narrative that there's also a conversation to be had with the regulator so that the goods that are put to market are fit for purpose in compliance with the regulatory requirements, that regulators in different markets can trust each other. And that requires conversations between regulators. It requires conversations between regulators and the various operators across the supply chain. So I'm broadening out your supply chain management theory from an academic point of view, from an operational point of view. It's just about, let's have a chat. Why are you asking for this paperwork? Why do you need to trust me? Why don't you trust me? These are the sort of conversations you can have. So the principles are quite basic. And the book is an opportunity to sort of maybe remind a reader, bring them down to the principles and away from all the jargon and what's contemporary. That said, certainly as an educator, a really good classroom exercise is, so why is this topic so important? And then instantly students will talk about sanctions, or they will talk about the lessons from COVID, or so you can bring that all into the classroom. And sometimes you can have those conversations in the classroom to also update your own content, which is lovely to see, especially when you involving training exercises with more senior policymakers, which sometimes I do as well.
But yeah, in the context of classroom, how might the subjects of borders and customs be taught in higher education?
I mean, there's different ways of doing it. And in part, it depends on the procedures within the academic institution itself. So I cut my teeth in the UK. Some of those institutions are hundreds, if not thousands of years old. Wheels turn slow. So you kind of have to almost shoehorn your subject into, which I did, into the logistics and supply chain management course. I know elsewhere, especially if when you start doing executive education alike, it's much more flexible. It might be demand driven. So it might be that you get a bunch of executives, or you might get a bunch of senior civil servants who want to have a conversation about this, and you can design training requirements to write those needs. And the nice thing about those sort of training events is whoever's in the room, they often bring in something really valuable that they already have. So much of the classroom is not so much having a teacher in front, waving around their book and say, you must read this, although I would do that.
And you should. Well, you should. Yeah.
But in addition, you might want to learn from the experiences of individual student participation. So as educator, there's some buzzwords going around, flipped learning, scaffolding, working with the room rather than preaching to the room. You can achieve some really good, impactful learning outcomes.
And that's the kind of work that you've been doing throughout your career. And as you say, patchwork, but it also means interdisciplinary. I mean, there's another way of putting.
Absolutely.
Seeing things from many different perspectives is invaluable in this world. Well, I'm going to ask you the final crystal ball question, which I ask everyone that comes on the PennCast. And there's no right answer, of course, but what do you see from your perspective as an expert in cross-border logistics operations? What do you see as the biggest challenges for the future of customs innovation, the areas most urgently requiring innovation, and the best ways to ensure that customs remains effective and relevant in the future?
I mean, innovation comes in many different ways. So it can be gradual improvement or continuous improvement. And that's sort of the long haul. And then there are the big ideas. So I think both dimensions are really, really exciting. And certainly trade facilitation, the long haul is changes to the regulatory environment, to the operational procedures, the organizational cultures that allow the public and private sector to work together, overcoming barriers such as maybe perceived corruption or mistrust, overcoming that. That's sort of the long haul. So the innovation here is working towards embedding in those big ideas over your regular operations. But then you have the big ideas, the shift change ones. And we are in an interesting time. I mean, you just have to look at sort of LinkedIn conversations, for example, and AI is just about in every thread and every hashtag. And we can certainly foresee a whole range of new tools. Some might say toys to play with. And with different outcomes, I just published a paper on assistive technologies and tariff classification as an example. There are mixed results, of course. So once you evaluate those toys, I'm sure many of them will really have a big impact. But I would just want to remind people that when you talk about innovation, it's also the long haul. So picking away, continuous improvement, making sure tools are fit for purpose, working with what you have is just as important as all the big ideas, ranging from x-ray scanning that can automate things at scale to machines and algorithms that will replace many, many staff, but you still want to make sure you capture their experience.
Brilliant.
So Andrew, I'm looking forward, for example, to a future of not just teaching students, but also teaching machines.
Fascinating, because data sets are the core of any future useful machine learning, right? And in order to, garbage in and garbage out, or good quality in and useful technology.
Absolutely.
Andrew, this has been just a foretaste of many important topics covered in your book, The Cross-Border Logistics Operations, Effective Trade Facilitation and Border Management, a book which I strongly encourage our listeners to read for one of the most comprehensive and important reviews of cross-border issues to appear in recent years. I look forward to another conversation with you in the future to discuss your broader views on pressing aspects of customs innovation in your 100 so articles, book chapters, and studies, and also your work on Horizon 2020 projects. I understand you've just begun work on Connector, is that correct?
Correct, yes. So that will be a lovely opportunity where we will be looking at interoperability between customs administrations, issues, challenges relating to information sharing, and making that environment between the various border agencies maybe just a little bit more interesting. And of course, I'm sure there will be lots of conversations about stakeholder needs. So maybe come back to me once I found my feet.
Indeed. I guess the kickoff meeting is in Athens and not too long from now.
Yeah, in a few weeks' time. So I'm looking forward to a trip to Athens. Yes.
Very, very exciting. Professor Andrew Granger, thank you very much for a fascinating conversation.
Oh, thank you very much, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Pushing the Envelope, Life at the Cutting Edge of Customs Innovation, a podcast that profiles leaders in customs and their views, ideas, and inspirations about the future of customs innovation. Join us for our next Pencast and another insightful conversation with customs trendsetters and forward thinkers. Thank you.